Programming Throwdown, episode 173, Mocking and Unit Tests. Take it away, Patrick.
I had a realization. I have too many headphones.
I also have too many headphones.
Okay, all right. So I was thinking about it, and I don't know how I want to approach this. We can approach this like a lot of different ways. But I was just thinking about how many different kinds of headphones I have in addition to just like the one. All right, so I was trying to think about it. I've been talking about it. We're going to talk about it a little later. It's my book of the show, spoiler alert. But I've been running. So I have a pair of running headphones that don't cover your ears because one, it gets really uncomfortable if you run for a long time and there's something in your ear, but also then you can't hear traffic. So I have these like bone conduction headphones for when I run.
Wait, what is that? I've never heard of a bone conduction headphone.
So it's kind of silly. They're just like, they focus on like vibrating a piece of plastic that goes just in front of your ear. Like your, I guess that's your sinus bone. And then so like for podcasts or like the gist of music, it's not a hi-fi experience, but it presses in front of your ear versus in your ear canal. So it's not shooting music into your ear. If you didn't know this, this is like snakes feel vibrations through their like bottom of their jaw. If you put your chin up to like something, you can hear with your ears, yes, but you can vibrate the inside of your ear without like sound waves injecting into your ear canals.
Okay. That's amazing.
So I use the same thing in like places where you can't talk loudly. They'll like have walkie talkies that use bone conduction as well. I think that's where the technology actually developed because the sound signature externally is a lot lower to other people. These ones aren't that great. Like if you were standing next to me, you could probably still hear it. And I can still hear it through my ear canals as well, but I can also hear it through not my ear canals. It sounds cooler than it actually is.
Are these really expensive?
No.
Or like,
I bought super cheap ones. You can buy even cheaper no-name ones, but I have I think Shox is the brand. Not endorsing them. I've not tried more than one. I just have one pair. I bought them on eBay because I'm cheap. Anyway, so just Bluetooth. So I go from my run. All right. Then I have, like when I fly, I have iPhone. So I have Apple AirPod Pros with the noise canceling and, you put them in. But I only really use them for flying because I know the battery is not great. And so if I use them all the time, and again, I'm kind of cheap. So like, I don't want to like burn through the life cycles of the battery. So, but when I fly, they're amazing because you put them in, you can put them in transparency mode. Don't do that on the airplane, but you can also, do the noise canceling. And that's just like my noise canceling. If I am listening to music, like at my desk, when people are around or whatever, I do have desk speakers, which are pretty nice. I'm not doing speakers. It's another episode. But I have, like more hi-fi headphones. So I have in-ear, they call them, I don't want to use that term because I don't know if that term is super appropriate, but headphones that come from China that you can order on AliExpress or whatever, and they're like good bang for your buck. So there's like brands like KZ or there's people like this guy Crinical. He does like in-ear monitor reviews. So I'll buy some, $20 or $30, have like three or four of them, this like Hexabase, this like other like in-ear, ones. But then I also have a Beyerdynamic like large DT770 with the, headphone amplifier that sits on my desk that I soldered together from this, plans online with PCB. So anyways, like,
wow, this is amazing.
The over ear with the thick quarter inch jack plug, but they're high impedance, like 770 ohms, I think, or something very high. No, that's too high. It's like 200, 350, something. Large amounts of impedance. You got to, have something strong to drive them. And then I realized I don't even have any of the normal old school, growing up, it was always like the cheap headphones, the earbuds. I have either the like thicker in-ear monitor style or over or the wireless, but yeah, too many. I think in a month, I probably use at least 5 or 6 different pairs of headphones.
I feel like headphones are kind of our, generation's shoes. Like I never was into like the Nike Air Pumps back in the 90s. Like I kind of was, I was too young for that. Well, I mean, maybe, yeah. But that was popular when you and I were like 7 or something. Right?
Yeah,
so we kind of missed the boat on that. But for us, it's headphones. Yeah, I also have, I have USB-C earbuds. One thing I noticed is like, yeah, I guess my headphone snobbery is that I don't want the 3.5 millimeter jack, like the analog. I only want digital. So I have a USB-C set of earbuds or earbuds. I have these like, I don't know what they are, but These actually use a 3.5 millimeter, but you know, you're at your desk and it's a very kind of there's not a lot of motion or anything, right? As opposed to when you're running with your phone. But I'll actually run with my phone in my pocket, a USB-C connector in the phone, and then the wires going to the earbuds. And yeah, they are kind of like a sweaty mess. So yeah, I probably need to do better there. But then I also have, for the airplane or when I travel, I have a pair of like over-ear headphones that are really nice because they don't, you know, they're not touching, like they're only touching your head, your skull around your ear. Maybe so it's very comfortable. But apparently I need these bone induction ones. That's
not induction, conduction.
Conduction.
Yeah. I forgot also when I mow the lawn, I have ear protection Bluetooth headphones. So I think I have to, oh man, I have.
Yeah, I actually use those for that too, but I don't have, they're not ear protection. That's interesting.
Yeah, I have ones that, yeah, they're like work like job site, like noise reduction, because I noticed lawn equipment is very loud. So,
And if we could do meta on top of meta here, I was going through all the Spotify comments. Thank you in general, folks, for comment on the show on Spotify, on other places. I do read them. Basically, the number one comment is like a variety of ways of saying, thank you, we like the show. And so thank you, we like doing the show. The number two comment theme is, oh my God, how does it take so long to get to the topic? And so I will just tell everyone right now, it takes about half the show to get to the topic. That's what we do.
Maybe we should split it into I don't know. We're not going to, but it's like really two shows in ones. It's the like casual, and some podcasts do that mix in the stream. They'll have a one kind of show and another kind of show. We really do have two shows. We just squish them together.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if it would be better if we put the show title in quotes, because I listen to.
I don't think that makes a difference.
Well, I listen to this guy Sebastian Maniscalco. He's a comedian. He's hilarious. He's Italian. He tells a bunch of Italian jokes. As a fellow Italian, I can kind of relate. He'll have the thing like trains will be the show title, and they won't get to trains until like 2 hours in. But it's in quotes. I think the quotes are where it's at. So it's because it's in quotes, you know that like it's not going to be just hit you over the head with trains.
Yeah, the other comment is I interrupt Jason a lot. I apologize. I do. It's a latency thing is my excuse.
Wait, really? I don't feel like that at all.
Oh, I don't. Okay. Also, a correction. I mixed up the guy who 3D prints speakers. I think his thing is Hexabase. The Crinicles headphones was the Truthier Hexa. So I have to self correct. So I don't have to feel bad about it later when I go to sleep.
That's the third most frequent comment.
No, I always feel bad. I often do realize that I say things incorrectly. It's just like, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally normal. We definitely say a lot more correct things than incorrect. We're batting pretty well.
Go ahead.
I'll continue the trend of doing incorrect things. I will show Patrick something that nobody else can see. So you're just going to have to give an audio version.
Secret.
But this is my Nintendo Snitch. All the people at home, you can't see this. What this is I took a Nintendo Switch controller, the Joy-Cons, which are just Bluetooth controllers that can plug into anything. I got a WaveShare LCD panel, and then I have a Raspberry Pi that's like mounted into that.
Wait, and then I have it up and showed me that it's like 8 inches thick.
I know,
on the front, it looked exactly like, I just thought he was holding up a Switch. I thought this was going to be a Yuzu, you know, news section, but like we didn't add that. Anyways, no, actually he is holding up a IED looking blue box that's like 8 inches.
Yeah, I 3D printed this box. And so then the WaveShare LCD panel actually comes with speakers. It plugs into the Raspberry Pi. And then on the Raspberry Pi is this obscenely large battery pack. This thing probably has a zillion hours of battery life, but it weighs like a ton. And then the battery pack has a two-prong connector that I connected to this button that I guess people use for like boats, but it still works.
It's a marine-grade waterproof button.
I have a marine-grade waterproof button on this 3D case, but if I hold the button down, it turns on. I'm not going to do it because it it boots into RetroPie. And I have all the NES, SNES, all those games on there.
Oh, what? Okay,
and,
but yeah. Does it have a fan?
It does not have a fan. It's all passive cooling.
Oh, okay. So the thing that the joke for people who have the Steam Deck is when the fan starts running, it produces like this very particular odor
that gives you cancer?
No, probably. I assume it's just like thermal paste or whatever, but
yeah.
Like, I smell the vent. Like you just like hold it up and you're just like, oh, it's the smell. I'm playing a good game because the guy's working hard, you know, the little, okay, sorry. If one time Steam Decks out there, they know what I'm talking about.
One time I opened a wrench set from Harbor Freight
and it had this
really nice smell of like, because of the plastic or the rubber, the TPU that they use on the handle of the wrenches. And then I got a cold right afterwards and I was pretty convinced I had SARS or something, but I still lived.
If you ever open surplus military stuff from like a really long time ago, it also has like this particular like varnishy smell from like some of the oil that they like preserved all the stuff in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyways, now people are definitely, I was going to say hanging up. This is not a phone call, so they're not hanging up. They're just,
if this was real time, you would just see in real time, the ratings plummet. No, I'm just kidding. All right. News. We'll jump into news. We'll cut our losses. My news article is Texas A&M University Physics Festival. I went here with my kids, had an absolute blast. You know, if you don't live in Central Texas, it's probably not convenient. But the real thing that I wanted to post about here, beyond just, you know, having a ton of fun, is this is really a win for social media. I'm not on Facebook or any of these things. I am on YouTube. I consider YouTube to be like the closest thing to social media for me. The only time I really go on Facebook or other social media is if people reply to our show. So, you know, we post the show through an app called Buffer. If anyone makes a comment on the show, replies to the show or anything, I definitely read it. And we have several interesting threads. But I personally just don't have it in my routine to go on any of these things. But I do go on YouTube. And YouTube recommended me this a video from this physics festival last year, and it really dialed in and knew that I would like it, knew the kids would like it. And we watched it, we enjoyed it, had a good time, and it was local, so I said, hey, let's look it up. We found out when the next physics festival was, which was this past weekend, and we've been eagerly waiting for the past few months. And then we went last weekend. And, you know, what I came away thinking about it, I think about was, you know, there's so much of a stigma about social media and all the damage it does and everything. And I'm not discounting any of that. But here was an example where, you know, I got recommended something from YouTube that I never would have even thought in a million years to look up, because we were watching a bunch of science things. And it happened to be kind of local, and it turned into like a real world day trip that we had a lot of fun. And so it's kind of like a win for social media that, you know, often these things go unnoticed.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you have some time, folks out there, check out if there are any kind of like physics or math festivals around you. When we lived in the Bay Area, there was a university, I think it was San Jose State. One of them had a physics festival, and I'd go every year. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, basically, they just do cool experiments. It's a lot like being in high school physics or chemistry again, where your teacher blows stuff up, lights the ceiling on fire, lots of fun stuff like that. You know, over the weekend, they made solid nitrogen, which you can only find naturally in like, you know, gaseous planets like Jupiter and Saturn and stuff. But they made it right there in front of us. So yeah, really, really cool. A lot of fun. And, glad I found out about it.
It looks like there's actually a map, at least for the United States, of, universities on here that have physics festivals. So I see one sort of near me. So I have something to do after the show.
Nice. Very cool.
Cool. My topic, which is a topic in itself, and I'll probably not talk about that topic too much, but talk about something slightly different. Anyways. Is there was a YouTube video from a Rust convention conference from Lars Bergstrom, who is a Google director of engineering, and he said something which I don't know viral, like I don't know what the bar is for viral. To Jason's point, I guess, like being on social media, I think I saw this one, I don't remember, on Hacker News or Reddit. But you know, got a lot of people engaged about it, and we're talking, which he had a slide in the slide deck, which was the thing that got passed around, saying that I'm going to sort of summarize here, but basically that at Google, they collect statistics, and that the Rust teams, teams programming in Rust at Google, were about as productive, or maybe even a little more. I don't remember. I think it was saying about as productive as the ones using Go, which Go is the language Google developed, and that they were 2x more productive than those using C++. So basically, I guess he, I don't know, whatever the equivalent of lighting a Molotov cocktail and throwing it into the internet was. This is not his words. Not, these are not mine. And this is interesting itself. And I was, we actually had a couple other C++ articles in here, but I took them back out. So maybe some other time, but there's this sort of feeling going around, and everyone kind of always has these battles, like what language is better than another. And so from some of the commentary that was interesting is that just metrics around like programmer efficiency are so subjective and difficult. Like you would think it's relatively easy, but just the amount of like this relatively straightforward statement, like, is this meaningful? Is this useful? Is this something that like you should incorporate into your beliefs about like selecting a project, a language for a project or a project to learn? Or is this just noise? Or is, you know, for everybody on one side, you can probably find somebody on another side. And just even the metrics were, you know, these teams doing greenfield programming, you know, just starting a program from scratch. Are they doing maintenance? I guess he was actually saying that, you know, that there, some of this was for people basically porting from C++ to Rust, and that they find, which again is difficult, is like C++ maintenance is very expensive and difficult. That is, like, to fix or add features to existing code bases takes, you know, some unit time relative to, you know, adding features. But then people bring up, well, maybe C++, the things implemented in them are themselves the more difficult tasks. And so, you know, adding a click box on a website is a different task than, you know, changing the compression scheme of, you know, Bigtable or whatever, right? So it was just an interesting discussion that even in a company with as many very talented engineers as Google, to sort of like understand, what should they do? What about what about what people know and don't know? Do you incorporate the cost to cross-train people in these other languages? Like, is it, if you go, you know, if you have C++, they also have a lot of Java, Rust, Go. Now they've got like how many Python, how many different languages do we want tools, infrastructures, and expertise in? This is like a very high dimensional design space to be in. And it is very interesting to watch as things play out over the years and years. And my preference is for sort of like learning. It's great to dabble your toes, this podcast, others in lots of languages, and then be slow on your sort of like core expertise, like what you're actually picking up and committing to and taking jobs in and that kind of stuff. Because you picking wrong is very expensive. And, you know, picking just something that doesn't get support or gets killed or dies off, which is, we can point to many things around that probably even we've covered on the show. But just, yeah, it's very interesting to watch as this long game plays out and people try to take measurements and sort of prove or disprove the status quo and sunk cost fallacy and, you know, all of those things about how to make decisions going forward. So anyways, there it is. Yeah. This person, Google Director of Engineering, saying that for them and their measurements that he was finding great value in Rust.
Yeah, I mean, I exactly, you covered it. I mean, I think there's so many confounding variables. It's like, you know, the language that we just started using, we're so much more productive than the one where we have 20 years of technical debt. You know, I mean, it's like a ton of confounding variables. I actually, there's an amazing set of Markdown files in a GitHub repo dedicated to teach people who are C++ engineers about Rust. And it goes through assuming you're really good at C++. I went through that and it gave me a really good handle on Rust. I've yet to need Rust or C++ for a new project. But when I do, I think I'll give Rust a shot. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all languages will evolve over time. It's good to know as many as possible so that when you go. So part of, I think, learning so many languages is that it frees you from making language part of the reason why you pick a job. You know, like you know, my story after, you know, I finished my college degree, and I went kind of like looking for my first kind of postgraduate job. You know, I ended up like writing JavaScript, and I had never really done it before. I'd only ever done C++ and Python. But you know, I think that if I had made language a big reason for choosing a job, I think I wouldn't have necessarily got the best job. So it's good to know a bit about everything. And yeah, take all of these things with a big helping heap of salt. But yeah, I do think that, you know, eventually like Rust, Go, these things will eventually take over C++. That's how it kind of how I'm reading it. I mean, what's your take, Patrick?
Ooh, I don't know enough quite yet. I mean, to be clear, people still program, like there are still assembly code needs to be written, you know, not as much as it used to. C is still written, probably not as much as it used to be. I think some languages, once they reach, you know, a certain level of critical mass, they probably don't go away.
Right.
And what you see is, I don't want to say like it's a zero-sum game, because I think every year more software is written, but I think what you see it is like the relative portion of new code getting written. I don't know. Again, this is a hard metric.
Yeah, when you're talking about percents, it's always a zero-sum game.
Yeah, and so, okay, yeah, fair enough. But I think C++ market share is probably not going to see new highs.
Right.
I think market share, it'll continue to be a core part of, you know, some, call it deep infrastructure or whatever, for a very long time. There's a lot of really great, you know, high performance software that exists in it, you know, and a lot of expertise in doing those kinds of things. You know, and so I think that will continue. But yeah, I think you're right. I think for a lot of stuff, it doesn't need to last for 10 years. And so, you know, the expertise for how to maintain and use that, you know, doesn't there. And, you know, I think Rust and Go, they're using Rust, you know, for parts of Linux and trying to, I think that's a great inroad to see it, you know, being used in software. And we almost talked about the White House memo on C++. I think that's another one, is just like by default, you know, just adding an extra layer of memory safety that is difficult in C++, although it has gotten much better. I think C++ probably won't ever see new highs, but I think there are some places where nothing else is even in consideration right now. So if you go to a game studio and you're writing a game engine, or I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Those people, there's so much, you know, you said tech debt, I guess, but like the reverse, like what do you call like tech inertia? Like right, there's so right. many utilities and math libraries and optimized spatial indexes and all of that stuff, and it's all in C++. It would be a massive investment to port all of that to something else or write good, you know, adapters for it. And all that stuff is continually getting improved. And so it's a huge sunk cost to just switch to another language.
Yep.
That was a totally non-answer. Very long-winded non-answer.
No, I think you're totally right. I think you really can't go wrong learning as many languages as possible. So if you're really into C++, you have nothing to worry about. If you are learning Rust and this is day one, you have nothing to worry about. I think all these languages are going to be popular for a long time. All right. My next news story is cosine similarity really about similarity? So let me kind of paint this picture for everyone. So in AI and machine learning, you have to, or maybe just in computers, you have to represent things with numbers, right? So yeah, just taking a really big brush here, like if you have an image, right, that image at the end of the day is a bunch of pixels, and each pixel has an RGB value, and so it comes down to numbers, right? So that image is represented as numbers and ultimately as bits, right? But you know, you might want to do things like say, are these two pictures similar? And you have to have some kind of like semantic understanding of similarity. The joke that always comes up is, I think this was like some joint project with the military and MIT like 80 years ago or something, but they trained this classifier that took in pictures of tanks and tried to predict whether it was a friendly or enemy friendly or unfriendly tank. And they collected a bunch of friendly tank data. they moved all the friendly tanks out of the way. They brought in all the enemy tanks. They flew over them. They collect a bunch of enemy tank data later in the day, train their model, and their model ended up being a time of day predictor, right? So it, because they had done one collection and then another at different times of day, the model learned, oh, when the sun is setting, it's an enemy tank, right? And so, you know, you can't use just raw pixels to, you know, you can't draw some distance function between raw pixels to say whether two images are semantically similar because of all these other effects, right? So what you end up doing is creating what's called an embedding, which is just like a semantic projection of a picture. And the way you do this is you have a bunch of humans tell you whether these two pictures are the same or not. And so now you have this data set that says, here's a picture A, here's picture B, and yes, they're the same, or no, they're not the same. So in the case of the tank example, you'd get two pictures, hopefully at different times of the day, but of the same tank, and a human would say, yes, those are actually the same, semantically the same thing. Once you have all these, this data set of triples of image one, image two, and whether they're the same or not, train a model, get an embedding. And so now you have a point. So you actually have a function that takes an image and turns it into a single point in some high dimensional space. And so presumably, you know, two points are closer together if they represent the same thing. Now, here's where it gets interesting is what if you have a point that's like a dog and you have another point that is like maybe one picture is a dog, but the dog is far away. So there's, you know, like a empty road or maybe like a green screen, or maybe it's literally just a white background and a tiny dog. And then you have another picture that's like a bunch of dogs filling up the whole screen, right? The second thing is like very, very dog, you know? The first one is less dog. And so, but they're aligned in that they both represent the same concept. The first one is just much more extreme or much more emphatic, saturated version of that concept, right? So people, when they're doing these recommender systems, this paper came out of Netflix, when they're trying to recommend movies and stuff, if you see Rambo, they want to recommend some other kind of action movie, right? And they don't want to not recommend something that is like maybe a little bit less action-y than Rambo, but is directionally aligned, right? So that's where this cosine similarity came from. So the deal with cosine similarity is you're just looking at the direction from the origin to that point. And so, you know, if the direction from the origin to Rambo, if that direction is the same as the direction from the origin to Top Gun, then they'll recommend Top Gun to Rambo and vice versa, right? What they're afraid of is if something is not too actiony, then it's just going to get recommended a whole bunch of other things that don't easily fit into any other category, right? So something that's like a little bit Rambo-y might get recommended to something that's like a little bit Barbie or something, right? And it just wouldn't make any sense. So cosine similarity is supposed to like prevent that when you're close to the origin. But TLDR, it doesn't work very well. They did a bunch of studies. I've always been very skeptical, so I'm kind of glad to see this paper come out. In general, it's good to read papers that affirm all of your pre-existing beliefs.
Confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias. But it's a fascinating deep dive into this, and there's you know other similarity metrics that work better. And in general, when you're dealing with all these complicated embeddings and stuff, you know, this idea of like direction, it kind of falls apart at high dimensions. And so it's one of these things like intuitively you could kind of picture in your mind like a clock. And yeah, I want like, you know, the two hands of the clock to be pointing in the same direction. But all your intuition falls apart when it gets to like, you know, 100 dimensional spaces. And this is just another example of that. Anyways, really fascinating paper. I feel like it's pretty accessible too. So it's pretty good. There might even be YouTube videos that explain it in better detail than reading the paper. But I had a lot of fun reading it.
Yeah, I think the struggle for me, or so interesting, I have to check this out because I'm curious what other alternatives they provide. But the thing you're mentioning where you have a vector that represents high dimensional space, and just even saying those words is something that always feels like just out of grasp for intuition for me. But when you read something that's like, what is the volume of a unit sphere as you move up in dimension? So like, you know, in 2D, you have a circle, in 3D, you have a sphere, you have like 4D, and you keep going up, and you start to get what I'll say is like very unintuitive. I mean, you can kind of just know it as a fact later, but it's unintuitive that like the number that's attached to the unit. So obviously like you get like meters and meters squared, meters cubed, meters to the fourth, which we stop losing. But the number that goes in the front, the behavior of that number as you go up in dimensions, like starts growing and like starts shrinking and then it gets like smaller and smaller and smaller. Like the geometric stuff that you start thinking about, like, because someone drew you a picture early on, doesn't always work when you start getting like you're saying, like to very high dimensional spaces. You're not even talking like more than finger and toes dimensions, right? Like you may have a vector which is 1,000 dimensions, and it's like your ability to reason about distance in that is probably like not super intuitive. And so, yeah, being careful about this, like you can't explain the concepts, but it's also, like you said, some things that you think should be really obvious could stop working for non-obvious reasons if you're sort of trying to build from intuition, at least as a, I'll say, a lay person in the field like myself.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think it's very hard to have intuition about these spaces. I mean, even researchers, you know, and so it's a lot of it is empirical and trial and error.
My last news article is about the XZ utility supply chain attack. Oh, that's a lot of words. So if you missed this, this news is pretty interesting because I think folks have warned about this for a really long time. And this one is notable because it actually was prevented. And they're still not 1,000% sure about, you know, the intentions and what was going on here. But basically, there is a library, XZ, that does compression, and it's used by a ton of Linux utilities. And an engineer at Microsoft who does a lot of work on databases. Oh, I'm not sure I want to say that. Andre, and then it's Freund. I'm not sure how to say the last name. You want to try?
Me neither.
Okay. I thought you were leaning in like you were going to say it. Okay. So pretty, like, it's just one of those things I've always seen it written. I don't know that.
I think Freud. I don't know. I'm going to look it up while you keep
Freund. Okay. Yeah. Ask ChatGPT, I guess. So they were doing some, you know, examination of, you know, some performance issues, and they were actually using tools you would use, Valgrind, and they were having performance issues with SSH. And they were trying to figure out what was going on. Why is it taking an abnormally, you know, like longer than it should? And they were trying to run it down, which in itself is very observant because most people are like, I don't know, like I'm on a sort of pre-release build. Like who knows? It could be flaky for many reasons, but they were going to run it down. And so they ended up, you know, sort of running to ground and figuring out that there was, you know, SSH depended on another library, which depended on XZ for some of its, you know, compression that it was doing, and that a change in there had triggered it. And people basically, like, that thread started to get tugged on and like unwound. And it turned out for basically several years that someone had started contributing to this package. And then they had done a couple sort of like weird, but not super sort of like problematic things, like, oh, let's turn off some of the performance monitoring for a certain configuration of the software, like fuzzing. And then through a sequence of sort of seemingly unrelated steps, were able to get code that would allow, you know, basically a backdoor to be installed to where if you sort of knew the special sort of key to send to SSH, like you could basically start to include your own payload and then run code. And yeah, basically it would be like anything that had SSH would just be, you know, a huge problem and be susceptible to this backdoor. And it's one of these stories where it seems like SSH was being targeted by something that was like two layers upstream, right? And this is why they sort of call this supply chain attack, which is if you think about software you're writing and think about the libraries that you depend on, and then the transit of the libraries. Those libraries depend on the libraries. Those libraries, those like, and so you hear this, you know, people, at least in sort of people I work with, you know, oh, it's so funny, you know, NPM broke because there was a left justify, or I forget what the, you know, a white space, you know, library that all these people depended on, and it got, you know, it got broken, and, you know, NPM went down, and ha ha ha, like, it's funny. But this was very serious. Someone had worked for years to basically open up the possibility of installing backdoors in SSH. And so it wasn't even something that was detected in the action itself. Someone just happened to be paying attention that code was taking a little longer than it used to, and basically found this out before it got widespread. If it had become widespread, the amount of work to sort of roll it back, or sort of like find all the places and roll the upgrades for, like, it would have been sort of months where this would have existed. And if it had, you know, gone a long time without being found out, who knows how, like, many versions would have, you know, had this in it. And no necessarily like call to action for all of us to go, just, it's just like food for thought, I guess, that, hey, we actually depend on, for software, so many things that you just can't possibly sort of be paying attention to and watching. And even if you are, if there's a determined, you know, opponent on the other side, like the sneakiness that they could be working with, it's just like, it almost becomes mind boggling.
Wild. So the way they pronounce the name is Freind, by the way.
There we go. Thank you.
But yeah, this is really fascinating. I highly recommend folks go to the show notes and read this article from Ars Technica, because it has some really interesting infographics. Actually, the whole article is extremely well done. But yeah, we actually interviewed someone a while back just on this topic. But I hadn't heard of such a high profile attack like this until now.
Yeah, this is relatively recent. And the curious thing would be, there's no way this is isolated, right? Like, there's no way, like, this one was found, and I don't know, call it just like sneaky suspicion. If we found this one, you got to imagine that there's 10 more, 100 right. more. I'm not going to, you know, there's the chance that this is the only one, especially, I mean, again, I don't think there's concrete evidence of this, that, you know, it being a state sponsored attack or whatever, but let's say it was, the chance that this is the only place they were doing this in is got to be approaching zero, which means there are probably other of these out in the wild today, or already happened, that we just haven't found out yet, or have, you know, haven't discovered. And so for cybersecurity, this is a, you know, talk of always about security in depth, right? Like, thinking through multiple layers and making sure that, you know, you don't just rely on one system to protect you, and just, you know, brings that to even more of a prominence.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating. I'm just speechless, because I'm going to have to read this in more detail afterwards, but absolutely unbelievable. I mean, this is kind of a side topic, but I do have folks, you know, come in with pull requests for Eternal Terminal, and they add flags and they update the README and all of that. I'm extremely grateful for that. But it does show that you really have to be vigilant. I mean, in a sense, I'm a bit fortunate in that I'm like benevolent dictator of Eternal Terminal, so I see every pull request. But at some point, we'll have to find somebody to manage that who will be vigilant, and you know, this can't happen to that library. It's just kind of a wild way to. Well, yeah. And in a sense, I mean, this would have affected Eternal Terminal, because we're still using OpenSSH.
Yeah, I think also the threat of, like, I'm going to, you know, sort of years in advance, put in some code in some place that isn't, you know, we're going to talk about unit tests today, and I put some code in some unit test, which maybe people aren't paying as much attention to. But then later, and sort of everyone knows that, and that's probably fine, right? It's just a test. But then later, someone, you know, then saying, oh, hey, this code over here, I'm going to put into a common utils thing so we can use it. You know, it's useful in tests. Let's just use it in our main library too. And now, because you're like, oh, that code's been there a while, like, it's sort of tested, there's nothing wrong with it. So you get this, like, it's credible by, like, maturity, which, you know, like, we never run into a problem with this code before. So you forget that we've never really thoroughly reviewed it. So maybe now it gets into a code that normally would have had a more thorough review, but because it's vetted code, except that it wasn't, you sort of slowly get this, you know, upgrading of privileges through the stack, where, like, code can kind of move from place to place if you're not careful about, like, even in your own code base, your provenance, like this code came from test. If it moves out of test, it has to undergo fully thorough review no matter what. You know, I that's not a policy that I would imagine most teams probably run with.
Yeah. Yeah, this is totally wild. Wow, fascinating. All right. yeah, my mind is just blown. I'm just reeling from that. So folks should definitely read that. On to book of the show. What's your book of the show, Patrick?
Well, I already foreshadowed it, but I read a book. I've been running more, trying to, you know, be fit, as you know, it's always a good goal for everyone.
Yeah.
And this is by Matt Fitzgerald. This book's a little bit older now, and it sort of shows his date a bit, but it's called 80-20 Running. I think at the time, this was a very substantial change to the way sort of, I don't say like anyone can go run, right? Like you got a pair of shoes, whatever, sure. And just go out and jog. But like, if you want to sort of like get kind of serious about, like we were talking about headphones, you don't want to just go on Amazon and buy headphones. If you want to like, what is a good, you know, what's the knee in the curve of the value to performance? You know, how much, what's the best headphones I get for $37? You can do research. If you're going to be like that, like me, with running, then you're sort of thinking like, hey, I can go out and run, but what's the best way? What's the best way to get better? Do I have to get better? No, I mean, but I want to get better. Like, this is good.
Are you trying to train for a marathon or anything?
I mean, I did run a half marathon. I'm not currently training for a marathon. I might at some point. I'm not doing it right now. But just trying to be able to run for, you know, at any distance, just run faster than I have before. So for longer distances, you can't run as fast, right? So you,
right.
You can start fast and then slow down, but you try to kind of pick the speed. You can go, you know, 10 kilometers or 10 miles, or, you know, as you're sort of working through these, just, you know, improving over time. And I've mentioned before, you know, tracking it through various websites and a running watch and this kind of stuff. You can see your improvement, and you can also see, you know, resting heart rate going down, your VO2 max going up. So things which correlate with longevity and health, you can also see improving. So part of it is, if you just run the same thing all the time, it becomes easier and easier to you. So the health benefit starts to go down as well, because you need to be.
Oh, I see.
So if your heart rate doesn't go up at all, right? Like, you know, if you've never walked and you start walking, and it's going to be a lot of work, but then you keep doing it, unless you're, you know, keep pushing a little bit. Now you have to go all out or even race, but you know, you just need to kind of always be exerting your body a bit. And so this book, though, 80-20 Running, talking about that. An observation from elite people and an encouragement to even amateur runners that, you know, to spend 80% of your running at what they call the so-called easy pace. If you get into, you know, heart rate monitoring, they'll call it like zone two, but basically go at a pace that you could talk at, and then 20% to do at, you know, what I would have done when I was younger, which is like run as fast as you can until you're, you know, got a stitch in your side and you're killed over puking on the sidewalk, you know, reserve that for, you know, 20%. The thing isn't to sort of run the same, but run it slower. The idea too is like, if you want to get more and more at the high speed training, it comes with a commensurate increase in how much time you spend at lower speeds. So an interesting book. It is much more accessible now that it's, the entry price for getting something to monitor your heart rate is really cheap. So you can either just get a strap or a watch. If you already have a phone, you know, that will pair with your phone and tell you what your heart rate is, so you can watch it. Nearly everyone can do it. You know, it's not a barrier to entry, really, in my opinion anymore. And this is something that elite folks, you know, struggle with being able to do. You couldn't target a specific heart rate because they didn't know what it was. And like running with your finger held against your, you know, neck is probably not a great way to count while you're running. But
yeah,
anyways, a very interesting book. If you're trying to get, you know, into running or serious about running, and running 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, marathons, and how to do it in a way where you are effective at getting better, and not getting injured. And this is a good book. Not very techy. I kind of come up with a good tech angle for it, but this is what I was reading about. So,
oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess, like, I mean, you know, goes without saying, take care of yourself. You know, I think I think Patrick and I mean, we're definitely not pro athletes by any remote stretch of the imagination. I have zero hand-eye coordination. but like, you know, we do like take care of our body. I think it's really, really important. And I think a lot about my dad, who is, you know, in his 70s, and he's still just completely active. And he talks about it, things slowing down his body and stuff, you know, at that age, but he's still walking around. He's still doing all the same hobbies and everything. If you want to you know, have that kind of a life for that kind of a duration, you have to put in some effort to stay healthy. All right, my book is A Movie Making Nerd. So I used to love watching this guy's name is Angry Video Game Nerd is the name of the YouTube channel. The gentleman who plays Angry Video Game Nerd is James Rolfe. You know, I've watched these shows for many years, had a ton of fun. I saw the book come up in Amazon. I thought, let me buy it and really just support this person who I thought has made a lot of great content. I went into it pretty skeptical. So I thought, oh, I'll read the first couple of chapters and then, you know, I'll just, you know, delete the book. But, you know, I felt like my job was done by buying the book. But it was amazing, actually. The first part of the book was phenomenal. You know, he has a very interesting background. He struggled a lot with anxiety and mental health and these things as a young child. And so he went to like a special school, like a special education school for most of his grade school. He didn't go to a traditional school until high school. Even that was like a really big decision where people didn't know what happened. You know, and I don't know, it could really, it really related to, you know, I think when I was like really into computers and programming and all these things at a really young age and at a time when, you know, like 1980, nobody's really into any of that stuff. But I think that, you know, it kind of connected, the book really connected with me on that level of like being really young, having like, so in this case, you know, despite the fact that the videos are all about video games and everything, the James Rolfe is actually not like a really hardcore gamer or anything. He's really a movie producer who found an interesting topic. And 90% of his movies up until he got popular with this one were horror movies and things totally unrelated to video games. So his passion is movie making, video making. But just seeing someone kind of have like a really strong passion very early in life and like all the challenges there and the anxiety that he went through and everything, I thought it was an amazing read. I will say it kind of falls apart at the end in the sense that, you know, if someone says, hey, you know, I've reflected on myself for 30 years and here's my conclusion, that's very different than like a month ago, you know, like, it's like when the book ends, it's like, yeah, you know, last month, you know, I made a movie or something. And it just, that part of it, it kind of fell a little flat. You know, I think it's a kind of book that ideally someone would write, like when they're very at the, you know, kind of at the end of their story. And this person's probably the same age we are, Patrick. So he's probably in their 40s, they're kind of in the middle of their story. And so because of that, the book could really end in a good way, a really conclusive way. But it is worth buying just for the first half of the book. And another thing, this is actually my first time ever doing this, I think ever in my life. I emailed James Rolfe and I said, hey, you know, the book like really spoke to me. You know, I thought it was awesome, you know, and you know, I didn't hear anything back. I thought, well, you know, this person doesn't really read their email. I mean, we barely keep up with our email and his video is like 100 times as popular. But then he wrote me back like a few months later. It's like a week ago, he wrote me back just like, you know, thanks for the kind words. So I thought that was super cool. I thought the book was a great read.
Awesome. I'll have to check out. I don't think I know anything about them. So this is a new, new.
Have you ever seen the, Angry Video Game Nerd? He like breaks Nintendo cartridges and goes crazy and stuff.
Okay. I don't think I have. This is one of those crazy things. Like you run across, and I haven't looked them up. If I open YouTube, it's going to start playing audio. So I'm trying not to do it. Try to resist the urge. But you'll run across someone. And it's like, oh, I have like, you know, 3 million followers. Like, how do I not? Have I never bumped into this before? The recommendation algorithm or whatever. I guess I'm just too cosine dissimilar from whatever topic that this person is in. So. Maybe they need the Netflix algorithm at YouTube and I would start getting recommended these videos.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how I got recommended it. I really can't remember. It's been so long, but I don't think that it randomly showed up, because I'm kind of with you. Like, if you were to look at my YouTube now, it's all like physics stuff, science stuff, geeky stuff, right? I feel like probably this came from a friend, but either way, it's a lot of fun.
Time for tools of the show.
All right. What's your
tool? All right, I'll kick us off. I have been one. So we talked about before Satisfactory, Dyson Sphere, program, right? Dyson Sphere program.
Yeah.
The Factorio. These are, I guess you call them factory games. Yep. You were recommending Cubic Factorium. I have it on my Steam wish list, although my backlog's way too long. So I have been wanting something to play on the go. I mentioned, you know, being on an airplane and, you know, just having downtime. I do have a Steam Deck, but it's kind of a thing to take out. You know, you can't just play it for a few minutes. And I had bumped into before, you know, in searching Factorio for iPhone. Of course, there's no Factorio on the iPhone, and I don't blame them. It would be kind of not the right fit. People always were recommending this web app, Shapez, S-H-A-P-E-Z. And I had tried it on the web, you know, kind of like, okay. Yeah. Recently, I don't think it's been around that long, they made a port to iOS and Android. And so I picked it up, and as a game, I much prefer Dyson Sphere program or Factorio. But again, they wouldn't play well on an iPhone or even, I do play Factorio on my Steam Deck, but because it's that good, Shapez isn't that good in my opinion. But it is fun. It does scratch that same itch, and it is mobile. So if you've never played Shapez before, I don't know how it is on Android and on iOS. I think it's free to download, and they give you a pretty generous demo that you can sort of play through. I think Factorio is the same way. Anyways, a pretty generous, you definitely get the gist. If you're not liking it, don't buy it. But yeah. If you're like, yeah, this is good. You know, I don't remember, a few dollars to sort of do the in-app purchase to unlock it. Play. So Shapez, not really a tool, but definitely fun.
Yeah. I'd be really curious how it works on the phone. Like, how do you get conveyor belts to go the direction you want and everything?
I mean, in general, you click and it kind of puts it randomly. But when you click the second time to sort of like connect them, it sort of figures out the orientation. So it can be really fidgety. Like if you have like two, an output and two inputs separated by only a single square. So like, you know, you have an output and then you have an input to, this is very hard from video, not from video. Anyways, if things are very, very close to each other, it's very difficult for it to determine what you're trying to do. But it knows like, if you're clicking, you're probably connecting an output if there's an output in an adjacent square. And then if there's an input in an adjacent square, that's probably where you want to go. So in general, that gets you through the vast majority of cases. But there are times where like there's two outputs that it could go to and it won't always choose the right one. And I have hit some glitches with the tunnels, like not like they look connected, but they're not connected. And so you have to like delete them and put them back in again. Overall, still, I don't know of any other game that is that cosine similar to Factorio. I'm going to just keep using that one. Anyways, it's in that same direction than this. And so it has helped me with this desire of mine. And it was one of those ones where sometimes you want something and you get it and you're like, that's not really what I wanted. This one was not that. So I've been enjoying
it. Oh, very cool. I'll have to check it out.
It is better on a tablet than a phone, I will say. But again, I have my phone with me all the time and not so much the tablet.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I have not tried it on my watch.
Shapez on the watch. Like zoom in. You have to use a little crown to zoom
while you're
in
running.
All the time.
Yes, that'll be great.
While you're running. My tool of this show is, I can't believe we haven't covered this, Dwarf Fortress.
No way.
Speaking of things that cause anxiety, Dwarf Fortress. You know, a game that has absolutely no saving, but you will like frequently destroy yourself.
I didn't know you couldn't save. Wait, I've never played it before. I know I've read much about it, but I've never played it.
It's like Minecraft where, the world persists. And so you can't really go back. So like in Minecraft, if you accidentally burn your house down, it's gone. I mean, you can obviously go in the file system and do stuff.
Sure,
but generally speaking, it's like it's gone once you make a mistake. Dwarf Fortress is on Steam. It's been on Steam for a while. Dwarf Fortress was free for many, many, many years. I think 11 years it's been in development. They went on Steam. They've sold, enough copies to make them, I think, something like $8 or $9 million between the two of them, which is great. They asked Tarn Adams, you know, how do you feel being like a millionaire? And his answer was like, well, you know, I would have made twice as much if I had just gone to Google or something like that. It was pretty funny. He's like, but you know, I'm pretty happy to be making half of a Bay engineer salary or something over 11 years.
Oh dear.
His answer is hilarious. He also panned all the game studios who are doing layoffs. Really harsh, actually surprisingly harsh. I've talked to Tarn about AI stuff in the past, extremely like nice, charismatic, just really mild-mannered person. I don't know very much about the games industry, so I don't have a lot of context, but in his interview, he was extremely fiery about the games industry layoffs and how they are, you know, not treating their employees really well, which is endemic. I mean, I remember that being a problem when we were looking for our first job, you know, like 20 years ago. Regardless, so Dwarf Fortress is out. I tried the Steam version. It's very well done. It fixes a lot of the user experience issues, you know, of the keyboard only version. It's not like a radical departure, you know. So like I wouldn't say if you're looking at it completely materialistically, you're not really getting your money's worth out of the Steam version. If you go and play the console version for free, it's not that different. I went and bought it, of course, because I've had so much fun playing Dwarf Fortress off and on for like a decade. The least I could do is throw Tarn like, I don't know, $7 or whatever it costs. But I would definitely recommend folks picking it up. It's a ton of fun. It has a high learning curve. From a user experience standpoint, it got kind of eclipsed by RimWorld, in my opinion. I feel like the UX on RimWorld is just so much better. And I do play RimWorld a lot more. But Dwarf Fortress is still a ton of fun. There's still really esoteric interactions between fluids and waters and dwarves and all of it. The funniest thing that ever happened to me was my dwarf crossbowman was blinded in both eyes, but still wanted to be a crossbowman. And when he trained, the shots went anywhere. And like about 1 out of 100 times while he was training his crossbow, he would kill like a horse or another dwarf or something. And even when he's not injuring the other dwarves, you could see the arrows just go randomly when he's training, which is hilarious. So very fun game, highly recommend.
This is a genre that, you know, you just mentioned RimWorld. People also say Oxygen Not Included.
Yeah.
And Dwarf Fortress. I haven't dipped my toe into this yet. I don't know whether I think the learning curve is too high or I'm too scared to waste all the time, but they're on my perpetual, like, one day I will waste time. Invest my time in also generating epic stories. Dwarf Fortress and EVE Online are the only, like, games I've ever seen people like. I'm sure there are others, but that I just routinely get surfaced to me, like just epic stories about. Both very complex games.
Yeah, one thing about RimWorld, I'll say for folks out there, if you want to get started in this genre, get RimWorld and get there's a mod that lets you. So by default, there's like slow, medium, and fast time. You know, most games have this, like you could play in real time or 2x real time, 4x. There's a mod that'll let you do up to like 1000x real time. And I mean, you wouldn't do that much, but basically lets you elapse time as fast as you want. I'm the type of person, I don't know if you're this way, Patrick, but if I'm playing these like real time strategy games, I'll want to basically like pause, do a bunch of strategic work, and then unpause. And I kind of turn it into a turn based game. Like when I used to play like Baldur's Gate 1, for example, it was, real-time strategy, but I was just pausing all the time. It was basically turn. And so I was doing the same with RimWorld, but then when you unpause it, you're going kind of at real time. So you're just sitting there waiting to pause it again, kind of waiting for something interesting. And so instead of doing that, just make it like really turn-based by letting yourself go like 20x real time.
I appreciate what you're saying. I don't know. I don't think I've ever done this before. I'm a pretty impatient gamer, so I think I would probably just suffer with it sucking at real time and then complain about it. But yeah. All right. Well, for those of you who are wondering when the topic would show up.
It is time. Unit tests, mocking. Let's jump into it. So Patrick, what is a unit test?
A unit test is code that you run to test a unit of functionality in your code base. I didn't look that up. That's Patrick's definition off the cuff. Yeah. But I think unit tests are one of those. I have never run into someone, I'm sure they are out there, who has said they do enough writing of unit tests. Unit tests are supposed to break down your code into a single manageable chunk of functionality and no more. And then you put that thing under test. You can go hog wild with that statement and you can end up in a sort of bad place in the design space in my experience. But I think you can go the opposite way and say, I'm never testing anything, make some excuse for it. And then you can have code that is just completely unmaintainable. And it's very difficult to make changes confidently because you don't know what is going to break because you don't test anything before you ship it. And we've talked about continuous delivery, continuous integration. You can't really do that unless you have some kind of testing, and unit testing is an important part of that, in my opinion. And there are certain things that really cry out to be unit tested. That doesn't make it easy though, especially as you start layering up functionality. It can be, without foresight and some of the stuff we're going to talk about, it can be very difficult to test something that depends on something that depends on something else, because getting the inputs just so that, and you know, it really exercises the thing you want to write your test for, and finding the corner cases you want to test can just become very difficult. I'll also say that, you know, I have run into code bases where it's a requirement to have full branch coverage even, right? So every if statement you get to, both the true and false, you know, for every for loop, you have to test every single bit of the code in every path. And that is important in some contexts. I will say it is very hard from a maintainability standpoint, because if you want to make relatively simple changes, especially refactorings, you can end up with just an enormous mountain of like unit tests that have to also be changed. And so I will say, I do think you can take unit testing too far. Maybe that's a controversial statement, but just in practice, I've seen that to be true. And you can also get the, I need to hit a quota of unit tests. And so I'm going to write useless unit tests rather than the harder but more useful unit tests I should be writing. And so you can get people who, I don't want to say game the system. They're like, this code's not going to get accepted unless there's a unit test. So I'm going to write a unit test that isn't really actually testing much, or is testing stuff that's not frankly very useful, rather than the extremes or the areas where it might break, or, oh, this code, if I test it this way, is going to throw an error and I don't want to deal with error handling, so I'm not going to test that part. So I will say that being real with yourself and your team about what purpose unit tests are serving and in your code base is really important.
Yeah, totally. I think if you're just getting started and you're doing maybe a personal project and you don't feel like you want to write unit tests, a good sort of, I won't call it a compromise because compromise makes it sound like you should keep doing this, but a good stepping stone to writing unit tests, even in your personal projects, is just to like be really aggressive about failing. So for example, maybe there's a place where you take a list of IP addresses and you do something with it. Well, like if the list is empty, you know, what should happen? Well, maybe you say to yourself, well, a list should never be empty. Well, fine. So put like, you know, if list empty, then throw an exception, crash the program, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you put this all over the place, guess what? Your program is going to be constantly crashing. It's going to be really frustrating. And so then you're going to say, well, you know, I need to, I can't deal with it like this. I need to, before I ship it, you know, get it to crash. And that's what a unit test really is all about.
That's a great tip, actually.
Yeah.
There's a separate thread there, which we should just not go into, about what happens when you encounter unexpected input. Should you, you know, report it? Should you throw exceptions? Should you just crash? And it's a separate topic. That's also a very controversial and thoughtful thing about what do you do when you encounter an input that do you check it? Do you expect it? Do you, anyways?
Yeah. I mean, maybe you write a unit test.
Fair enough.
So, you know, what I've heard, and this is, again, we're speaking from experience here. So this is not an academic exercise, but I've heard basically of three kinds of tests. You have unit tests, which is what we're talking about today. There's regression tests, where you're testing kind of a broader piece of software, like that has many branches and many if statements. And so it's testing like a bigger piece where you don't expect to really get high coverage, but you're expecting to see kind of interactions between different modules. Then you have system tests where, you know, you're really like you're calling, you know, int main with like a certain input and expecting a certain output. That's more like a black box thing. How do you break down tests? Is it similar? Is it different?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. I in a similar vein, I guess it's, and this will lead into to sort of the other part we want to talk about. I just think when it's small enough, you are able to create truly synthetic data. And, you know, at each module, you purposely construct something. When you get to some level of complexity, I don't know, make something like FFmpeg. So FFmpeg has all these math functions, right? You can feed it synthetic data to those math functions pretty easy. Whereas synthetic, like what would it mean to synthetically generate like an, you know, MP4 video that goes into FFmpeg and check that the, you know, AVI with MP5, I don't know, is that a thing, codec coming out the other side? Like how would you, if you think about that, the syntheticness of the data is best when you kind of keep it small. And when you get to so-called like golden data sets or just making sure it doesn't crash, right? Make sure you give it some input and your program does something but doesn't crash or throw an error. That's when you start to move off of unit tests onto some other kind of test and being careful about which goes in which bucket. But I think it's similar to what you're saying. It gets to be a regression test or just a full end-to-end test. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So when you're writing unit tests, you will eventually run into this problem where you want to unit test something and that thing makes an RPC to a database or checks the system clock or does one of these things. And you will say to yourself, like, how can I unit test this? Right. And so the wrong thing to do is to like only run your unit test at like 7:58 p.m. and it only passes at that time. That is not robust. You're going to have all sorts of problems. You might also have your unit test, you know, actually query the database. This is also a problem because if your database goes down, your unit test starts failing. Your unit test might query data that might not exist tomorrow, and your unit test will fail for that reason, right? And so, as Patrick said, the unit test, we're not testing MySQL. Like MySQL is good. they have a bunch of people testing it already. You want to just test your code that calls MySQL. And so what you need to do is test your code, but not test the MySQL part, which is right in the middle of your code. And there's really two ways to go about this. You have faking and you have mocking. Now faking is pretty clear. So for example, let's say you have a function that gets the time of the day and does some stuff to it, right? So instead of calling like the time function, the low-level kernel time function to get the time inside of your code, inside of your function, ideally you pass in the thing that gets you the time. So you pass in, could be a function pointer, or you could wrap it in a class. But imagine you pass in like a clock handler class. And the real clock handler just calls the time function and returns. But you could pass in anything, any class that, you know, inherits from this clock handler task. So you could make a fake clock handler class that extends the clock handler class, except when it asks for a time, it always gives you, 1980 or something. And so now you have this ability to have a repeatable, time. Every time I call the time function, I get exactly the same thing. And so my unit test now is fully repeatable. That's faking. And that is one way to do it.
I think also I believe this is called dependency injection. So dependency injection is like, yep, like you're mentioning, is that you're injecting the thing you want to depend on rather than it sort of like being inherent. So rather than a class owning an instance of MySQL, you pass in a pointer to a MySQL-like object, and you know, you're injecting the dependency normally at construction time or at execution time. Also has benefits for other reasons, but is definitely useful for testing.
Yeah, totally. Totally makes sense. Yeah, I mean, you know, if this function is already taking like the MySQL client, then you don't have to do a whole lot. But you're right. If you're using, for example, a MySQL singleton, then you're going to have problems, right? Because you have to somehow fake out that singleton. And that's actually a good segue to mocks. So imagine you have a singleton and you want that singleton call to be faked out. You can't really create a fake singleton. I mean, maybe you could with some really clever pointer stuff, but generally, you know, you can't just replace that singleton with something else, but you can use kind of a mocking system to handle that. So Patrick, how would you describe the difference between fakes and mocks?
So the way I've seen it before is the mock, and this is probably wrong, so you're going to have to, you know, step in here, is the mock is generally a way of trying to use reflection or automated method, sort of mirroring, mocking, right? So you have an object, and rather than sort of like you're saying a fake, whereas I custom build another class, and then I have some, you know, interface that I'm inheriting from or some, you know, abstract class. Instead, you're saying, hey, I have an existing class. I am going to script the way that that class is called, and I'm just going to create a sort of automatically generated version of that that looks the same. And so you can sort of via various mechanisms, depending on languages, you can lie to the runtime and say, hey, this is that class, except you've said expected this function to be called and then that function to be called. And now you're sort of like testing two things. You're testing that the output is correct, but you're also testing that the interaction with that object is correct at the same time because you've scripted this mock, which is you could do in a fake, but you would have to do it sort of from scratch yourself rather than using a framework for doing it.
Yeah, I think you did a great job. Okay. Yeah, basically a mock is just taking fake to the next level. So so just continuing the time analogy. Yeah, I think you had a great way of explaining it. If, you know, if I create the fake clock and I just return 1980 every time, you know, that's great. My unit test will pass or whatever. But what if there's a bug later where somebody, maybe this gentleman, Jia Tan, who's trying to like illegally break into SSH, maybe he goes through and takes your function and tries to like literally make it return 1980 all the time and not even call your clock handler. Your unit test will just continue to pass. It's not going to catch that. So ideally, you know, a fake clock handler, you know, you could in the unit test say, hey, here's my fake clock handler, and I expect the get time function to be called exactly once. The way you would implement that under the hood, if you're using fakes, is, you know, the fake clock handler keeps a count of how many times, you know, the get time function was called. When you call get time, it increments that count, returns 1980. And then at the end, you could check the count, right? So again, you could do all of this with fakes. What mock does is do all of that for you. So mock keeps track of all the times all the functions were called that you're interested in. It just has all of that scaffolding done for you.
I guess like to try it, which is difficult. I'll try another way to motivate it. If you have a logger, which do tend to often be singletons or whatever, your code may have a contract that says you need to take the square root of this value. But if you can't, okay, it's negative, because you know you're not supporting complex numbers, you should return an empty sort of optional nullable thing, but also log an error to the logger. That unit test is going to be difficult to write unless you mock the logger, because now you want to test two things. You want to test the return, which is normally what you think about with the unit test, is controlling the inputs and checking the return. But here one of the inputs actually needs an additional action performed on it, right? The logger could be an input, but it needs to have a function called on it. And so this is where, you know, you're not just checking how often it's called, you're also checking, like, it may be part of the contract that in an error, the error needs to be cleared from the MySQL connection. And so if you cause an error to happen, you need to make sure that it gets cleared. And if your code maybe returns an exception too early and doesn't clear it, then the next piece of code can't continue. And so then the mock is going to help you there. Be prepared to check those things.
Right. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Another thing that mocks will do is, and this is kind of language dependent, but sometimes it'll save you from some of the like inheritance problems that you can run into. So, you know, like Python, for example, has magic mock, and you know, Python is not strongly typed, which makes this a lot easier. But yeah, you can run into some, you know, kind of challenges when you're trying to fake certain things, and magic mock will just kind of take care of a lot of that for you magically, as the name suggests. So it'll do some weird Python voodoo, which I've definitely never dove into, but it will basically allow you to stub out things that might be really difficult, like global function calls, you know, crazy things with polymorphism. So, you know, I would say, as far as maybe jumping over to, we've kind of explained what they are, going over to sort of how to use them. I think as a beginner, you know, we talked about failing often in your functions, you know, like before just using the first element of a list, check if it's empty. And if it's empty, just fail, like fail really loudly. You know, that's a nice stepping stone to unit tests. And then unit tests will kind of naturally lead you to mocks. When you start, you know, kind of testing things so I'll give you another example, networking, right? So when you make a networking call, you can get a whole bunch of different errors. You could get, you know, error, the network wasn't initialized correctly. You could get, you know, SIG pipe, you could get E pipe, you know, both of those meaning like different parts of the connection died. Like the connection to the kernel could die if you're trying to create too many TCP connections. The connection from your machine to another machine could die. That's E pipe. And it can get, you know, really difficult and cumbersome to kind of catch all of these and handle them the right way. And so your magic class, your magic you know, network handler class will just get more and more and more complicated. And you can actually see this in Eternal Terminal, where I have a fake, I think it's called fake network handler, or no, fake socket handler class. And it's just obscenely complicated. And so I think, you know, most of that complication could be burned down by using a mock. And so, you know, being really aggressive on failing when you get things you don't expect will kind of naturally lead you to fakes, you know, to unit tests and fakes. And then fakes will lead you to mocks, as long as you know about them. You know, I think this is actually a kind of a meta point, but you often see people, and we're definitely guilty of this, like just doing the hard thing because they don't know about the easy thing, you know, this is one of these examples where you can end up making really complicated fakes because you don't know about mocking libraries that are doing a lot of that for you.
Yeah, maybe it's a language thing. I will say Java builds were pretty complicated. So using mocking in Java for me was, I don't know, like a no-brainer, but it wasn't any worse than, you know, hoops we were already jumping through. I will say I have not used mocking in the C++ stuff. Like getting a unit test sort of thing set up was, I don't want to say, bad enough and requires maintenance.
Yeah.
But we tried to do the mocking thing for a while, and just the way that it requires you to sort of do it at the build time and interrupt and do it, just as the juice isn't worth the squeeze, like it was very difficult for us. So I think I will say, knowing about it is very important because there is a bridge, and depending on the kind of thing you're interfacing with, that trade-off could be very different. If you have one thing, faking it could be an option. If you have you know, 15 different services that all have like different kinds of return codes that they could give you and this kind of stuff, right? Then that grows and the trade-off becomes different. But I think dependency injection, unit testing, and mocking, whether you do roll your own, whether you, or I guess mocking versus faking, whether you roll your own or use a like existing framework or library, different ones of them have different balances, but I think it is one of those things that with experience and with your build setup and in your instance, your answer may be different. And sort of making a blanket statement can get you into sort of complexity you didn't want to be in.
Yep, totally agree. Yeah, I think, you know, Java is so verbose and prescriptive that I think mocking makes more sense because every fake class is now adding like hundreds of lines of code. In C++, you know, where you can kind of do various tricks. I used Google Mock at Google, but I mean, if I, you know, just, I'm thinking about it critically now, like if I went back and used fakes, I think it would be pretty much a wash. So I think for C++ mocking is, you know, you can get away with a lot more using fakes. And so that makes mocking less useful for something like Java, where you can't really get away with a lot. I think mocking, you know, becomes more useful there.
We didn't put it in the title, but I will say dependency injection is one where I've never used a framework. There are frameworks for it. The concept I think is important to understand and know, but I will say the frameworks come, There is an appeal, but there is a hurdle to jump over before using them. And sort of like in the extreme, you know, whether you inject a Postgres or MySQL client, you know, at runtime via config is kind of cool. But you know, the trade-off, the cost of doing that is, they are, in my experience, they're pretty cumbersome.
Yeah. I mean, I've always despised dependency injection frameworks. So we used the Java one. You probably use the same one. I forgot what it was called, but you know, it's just such a pain. You know, in general, things that like generate code or like code paths, not things that generate code, like Protobuf is amazing and it generates code, right? But this kind of thing where like you read a config file and it like, you know, just autonomously spins up different classes depending on the config file, it's just always so much more trouble than it's worth. You know, and then you have like you know, this decorator dependency mm-hmm. injection, but you still have to kind of say what you want to inject. Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I think the concept extremely important, right? Like, you know, calling the Unix time function in your function directly is going to make that function now almost impossible to test, right? So the concept of trying to keep things stateless and passing in different handlers, that's great. But the dependency injection frameworks, I personally haven't had a good experience with them.
Yes, I think Juice is the one. It's
Juice, that's right. Oh man, I'm starting to get PTSD now. not a big fan of Juice.
I think we wove it in. I will say, if you get to the point where you think you're going to write one of these yourself versus using a framework because the framework is too big of a hurdle, I think you got to have a sit down. Like, are you just suffering from not invented here? I'm not saying that. I'm just, you got to really be honest with yourself there.
Yeah,
that's slightly different. So writing something that's a series of macros or, you know, code generators, whatever, yourself is a large undertaking, and likely you end up in a very similar destination unless you know that there's some reason you're not going to pattern match to one of the existing solutions. You're likely to end up with the same trade-offs that they do. That isn't the same as choosing that one of those frameworks is too heavyweight for your situation. And so you're going to sort of do it manually. I think that is a valid trade in this space. Not in all space, but like in this space, I think, you know, this is a valid trade. I've never seen someone, well, I shouldn't say never. I do hear people all the time for serialization say that they're just going to do it manually and that go very wrong rather than use Protobuf or an existing sort of, you know, serialization library. So I wouldn't say the trade is the same here, but I have seen people do sort of dependency injection and mocking and, you know, testing and faking sort of on their own, and it can be the right tool for the job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, particularly if you're doing faking, you're almost certainly doing it homebrew, right? Because at the end of the day, it's just a class that extends your class. Yeah, it's a good point. I think that's a really good dialectic. I think, you know, if you're doing serialization, deserialization, you really don't want to write that yourself for a number of reasons. You know, one, if you mess up serialization and now you have this bad data, you can't fix it. It's like if you went out, like imagine you're building like an AI stethoscope or something, and you're harvesting a bunch of data to improve your product. Well, if like you collected the data, you know, you didn't serialize it correctly and all that data is bad, well, like you're just out. And if you already shipped the product, you're just toast, right? So on the flip side though, you know, testing hopefully is one of these things that is like very agile, very repeatable. And so, you know, switching testing frameworks isn't a big deal. You're not really out, you know, a bunch of time and energy. It's not something you can't recover from. And so, yeah, starting small, building yourself up to eventually using, you know, fakes and mocks and getting more and more dependencies kind of injected versus using a bunch of singletons. These are all things that you can improve over time. And so you don't have to jump into some like commodity solution.
I'll also just throw out where we're at it. Cryptography. Don't do your own cryptography.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Do not ever do your own cryptography. I actually, there was a set of cryptographers or security engineers or something who evaluated Eternal Terminal, and they were like kind of rude. I mean, I just to be frank, I mean, I don't know if you're listening, but they were like a little bit just kind of like harsh. But then they saw that basically I was just calling Libsodium. They're like, okay. They kind of went away. But I could understand. I think if you build your own cryptography, you're just kind of asking for it. Do you remember the I was translating all the programming Throwdown episodes to Hindi?
Yes,
which is okay. Something folks should check out. We probably talked about it, right?
Yeah, we briefly, yeah.
Okay. But so I went back and listened to the first episode as part of doing this. Well, the first thing we talk about is actually Sony trying to implement their own cryptography. And
is that when the PS3 keys got hacked?
Yeah, that's right. There's a place they were supposed to return a random number. They returned 5 or something. So. Yeah, I think Protobuf, Libsodium, don't try and compete with these.
There is something interesting about, never mind. We don't have that. Like current gen consoles and the keys. And I will say they seem to get jailbroken, whatever you want to call it. Like it takes a lot longer than, you know, back in PS2, PS3, whatever, DVD, like these kind of things that, you know, needed a key and the key was like, I don't know, it's not my space, but it just seems I hear a lot less of the news about, you know, private keys for, what is it now, the Xbox X? Anyways, yeah. You don't hear those news articles as much. And so somebody somewhere must have upped their game or they've learned from their lessons. And I don't think the same situations apply.
Yeah, I think they've upped their game. I mean, I think that they have hired a lot of people who like used to work on bank software and these kind of things. And they just don't mess around anymore.
I guess I'd say like, if you're one of those people, reach out, it'd be cool to talk to you, except that like, you probably aren't allowed to talk about anything interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like when you retire, reach out to us. I saw someone, now we're getting pretty meta, but I saw someone on LinkedIn. They recently left a job and it was like one of these things where you buy and sell stocks, like what's it called? Quantitative trading.
Okay.
Or something. But hedge fund trade. Yeah. And they basically had to not work for a year. And they literally put in their LinkedIn job history 1 year. And it's like waiting for non-compete to expire was their job title for that year. And yeah, I guess that's still a thing.
Yeah, I think there's like, they call that alpha or whatever, which is the not explainable by market return advantage your trading strategies have. So the verse that, which would be beta, just, you know, market goes up, we go up. Alpha, the alpha that you have has a half-life to it. So if you work at one of these, you know, big hedge funds or proud hedge fund, or your hedge fund just wants to seem like they're as good as everyone else. You have this like knowledge at that moment. These are the trading strategies we're running. This is what we're looking at. They want that, you know, they're basically willing to pay you to keep you from taking that to another firm, because again, like they'll just, then you would just take it to those people. It'd be very hard to prevent you from doing it. And then the opportunities will close because now you have someone who's in there bidding with the same knowledge as you. And so the prices will go up. And so, yeah, I think in the finance industry, those things are, especially those trading, are very common. Whereas like you or I, like if we left, someone could sue us if we, when that happens in the news from time to time, like, you know, you took a trade secret, but there's a, not this like at the moment, these are things that are directly being exploited to extract profit. And other people knowing them is instantly detrimental to our bottom line.
Yeah, I didn't realize they paid you for that year. That's pretty awesome.
I don't know, like golden parachute. I think it, I don't know how it's either like when it's worked in, but it's something you kind of know going in, basically.
Got it. Makes sense.
I've never had one of those offers. If anybody wants to like pay me a year to not work, I reach out.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds awesome. Sign us up. Cool. Any last thoughts about, I'm trying to think if there's things we didn't quite cover. Oh, and kind of an adjacent thing. If you haven't already out there, check out GitHub Actions. You know, it's amazing. You know, I use that to run all the unit tests on Eternal Terminal. Every time anybody submits a pull request, it runs, kicks off like 12 GitHub Actions that go and run a bunch of tests. And in general, it's like, it's free compute. Free compute from GitHub. I mean, don't use it to mine Bitcoin or anything like that. They'll ban you. I've heard of people trying to do that and getting permanently banned from GitHub. Getting permanently banned from GitHub would be absolutely destructive. I mean, I guess you could always make another email account. I don't know really how they enforce that, but it just sounds like one of the worst things that could happen to an engineer. So don't do that. But you know, as long as you're being honest about what you're doing. GitHub Actions are amazing. I have GitHub Actions to build MAME and MAME Hub. It takes like about 2 hours on a 4-core machine or 2-core machine. And so it's a phenomenal product. And so, you know, once step one, write unit tests. Step two, use GitHub Actions to kick off all your unit tests.
Yeah, I guess I do have one other thing before we thank our patrons, I guess, we didn't talk about it, but code coverage tools. You know, I spoke about not going for branch coverage. I will say, not to overstate it, if you write unit tests and you never run or attempt to run code coverage, it's sort of like debugging by print line versus, you know, using an interactive debugger. You think you're testing one thing and you run code coverage and you realize you're missing whole swaths of functionality, but it just running them hand in hand, if possible, is just like a completely different experience than writing unit tests with no feedback on what lines are actually running in your units.
Yep. Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a whole nother show, but there's
I was going to say, not to drop that late, but I totally blanked on that.
Yeah. Amazing code coverage tools. You know, if folks Google it, you can find them. They integrate really well into GitHub. Same kind of thing. They run automatically. You don't have to do anything. We should definitely do that as a separate topic, but it's a really good point. And the other thing too is you want to have some kind of validation. You know, when you write a unit test, you want to see that that actually made the code a little bit safer. So code coverage is a good way to just give you a number for that.
Thank you to our patrons.
Yeah, thanks folks out there. A lot of interesting emails. Someone asked us to cover Laravel, which I haven't heard of in years, but I guess it's still popular. It's like a web framework type thing. We might have to go off and do some homework on that. Tons of email, tons of great support. Thank you for folks out there. No, we're not going to just talk about the show topic. That's not going to happen.
Are we going to put up a countdown timer to when ChatGPT just generates all these podcasts automatically?
Oh, how do you know they're not generating this one?
Are you a robot?
All right, folks, it was really great covering another cool topic. Shoot us more topics. You know, a lot of these topics come from you. So, you know, when you email us, that turns into shows. So thank you so much. Keep doing it.
Thank you to everyone who lasted this long.
Bye-bye.
Music by Eric Barndollar.
Programming Throwdown is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 2.0 license. You're free to share, copy, distribute, transmit the work, to remix, adapt the work, but you must provide an attribution to Patrick and I, and share alike in kind.